It's 2100 hours in Abu Dhabi, 1900 hours in Zurich, 1800 hours in London, and 1400 hours in Quebec. Midori House starts now.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller, and Dom Reynolds.
Coming up on tonight's show, sectarian fighting erupts in Lebanon. Is the strife in Syria about to overspill its borders?
Pyongyang pulls Beijing's tail by staging what might be the weirdest extortion attempt of all time. We'll ask how China's usually unyielding foreign policy might cope with this bizarre challenge.
And we'll meet Patrick Flannery, author of Absolution, a novel examining memory and reconciliation against the apposite backdrop of modern South Africa.
All that and more, and some music as well, coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead of us as ever, but first, the world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Prosecutors on the second day of the genocide trial of the Serb general Ratko Mladic have announced that they were indefinitely suspending the presentation of evidence. Earlier, prosecutors described 5 days of terror in the Bosnian enclave of Srebrenica in July 1995, when troops under Mladic's command massacred more than 7,000 unarmed Muslim boys and men. Monocle's correspondent Adam Labor told this morning's edition of The Globalist that unfortunately many people involved would escape justice.
The trial will show very clearly the mechanics of how Mladic conducted his wars, the total disregard for the Geneva Convention and the usual rights of prisoners and civilians in war zones. And it will be an extremely useful exercise, and I doubt this will be extremely harrowing as well.
The Olympic torch is due to arrive at the most southwesterly point of Britain tomorrow before it embarks on an 8,000-mile, 8,000-person journey around the country. Organisers deliberately chose a lower-profile relay than the route for the 2008 Beijing Olympics after violent demonstrators against China's human rights record and its policy on Tibet. The Metropolitan Police Assistant Commissioner, Chris Allison, said he didn't think Britain would see such disturbances.
Well, I sincerely hope we're not going to see those things. Those were protests about the particular regime that was existing in China at that time. I don't think we're going to get protests like that. I sincerely hope we don't. I hope the focus of the whole country will be allowing these 8,000 people who deserve the opportunity to carry the torch to be allowed to do it, get their moment of glory, because it is a fantastic opportunity for them.
The Israeli Defence Minister Ehud Barak has arrived at the Pentagon today for a meeting with the US Defence Secretary Leon Panetta. The United States has pledged nearly $700 million over 3 years to help pay for the Iron Dome missile defence system equipment, which can destroy rockets 40 miles away. Barak is also expected to raise the issue of Iran's nuclear programme, despite assurances from the United States that they're doing what they can to stop it. On the same theme, Australia and Japan have signed an information security agreement today in a bid to deepen bilateral defence ties between the two countries. The Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr hoped it would boost mutual cooperation and promote the protection of military information.
I'm very pleased that the Foreign Minister and I have just signed our information security agreement. There's been great growth in the strategic and security relationship between Australia and Japan, and it makes sense given our shared values and that we are both allies of the United States.
South African maritime authorities are trying to salvage a Japanese fishing vessel that ran aground in Cape Town's premier Clifton Beach. The salvage master, Guy Pouchet, said they were trying to prevent any pollution by pumping out the oil.
Complications, all the preparations have been done, but the vessel is quite old, and the stern section is quite flimsy, so it's not really strong. So we've got a team of specialist welders now and fabricators on board making up a box frame inside the vessel in order to make a strong towing connection.
And finally, a giant sturgeon weighing more than half a ton has been caught by startled fishermen in northeast China. The Kaluga fish was caught in a river in northeast China near the border with Russia. The sturgeon was female and carrying about 1.2 million eggs. Kaluga fish are believed to have been existing for at least 130 million years and are claimed to be the largest freshwater fish in the world. The fish is listed as critically endangered, having been fished to near extinction for its valuable roe. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Although if that report does come from the fishermen, we should probably assume that the sturgeon weighed no more than a quarter of a ton. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, China is unaccustomed to playing the role of victim in its dealings with rival powers. However, they appear to have every right to feel aggrieved in their latest brush with unruly neighbour North Korea. According to Chinese state media, three Chinese fishing boats with 29 souls aboard have been hijacked by a North Korean craft. North Korea is now demanding the curiously trifling ransom of US$190,000 and saying that if they don't get it by close of play today, they'll sell the boats. So there.
Now, given China's physical, economic and military heft, it's been accustomed to getting its own way in the world. It wouldn't be a surprise to learn the motto of its foreign ministry translates as talk to the hand. But they might need to learn a little flexibility, perhaps, as their influence grows. Well, we're joined now by Kerry Brown, head of the Asia programme at Chatham House. First of all, what on earth is North Korea playing at?
Oh, I mean, there's all sorts of problems about, you know, kind of who makes the decisions for them to do this. And a lot of it is kind of ad hoc. And so it's difficult to say that there's some kind of command structure where people at the top are kind of, you know, giving instructions for this sort of thing. It might be opportunistic and then kind of someone tries to get hold of it and give it some sort of, you know, kind of a strategic shape. But, you know, I mean, I think recently North Korea has shown in the sort of missile, you know, kind of test in April and these sorts of events that it's got a pretty inexperienced leadership now. And, you know, this is becoming an increasing problem.
How good is China at dealing with something like this, which is the pinprick rather than the massive foreign policy question? Is its bureaucracy good at reacting to micro problems as opposed to solving macro ones?
Well, I mean, I think it will prevail by just basically saying some harsh words about, you know, we're your biggest giver of aid, we're your biggest giver of investment. Without us, you're nothing. And that's the fact, you know, that China is the sort of sole kind of good partner of North Korea. And to alienate it seems a, you know, pretty dumb thing. So this is kind of very unusual in a way. This is a kind of really sort of strange thing. What I come back to really is the, you know, kind of issue of this is a leadership where the main leader, Kim Jong-il, died last year. And so you've got a kind of, you know, pretty reduced, pretty weakened leadership. And Kim Jong-un, the current, you know, sort of dear leader, as it were, is very young. I mean, maybe 30, no one really knows. Doesn't really know, you know, what is his sort of, you know, kind of real powers. There's all sorts of rumors. And what evidence we've seen so far is, you know, one massive policy mistake with, you know, this missile sort of, you know, this agreement with America. And then just a few days later, you know, kind of, you know, sort of immediate, you know, sort of problems because they, you know, kind of didn't, they sort of, you know, went against it and let this missile off. And, you know, that's a big, big mistake and caused a lot of problems. And so I think we get from that the idea that a lot of inexperience in this leadership and maybe, you know, in the system itself, some divisions and, you know, no real easy way of dealing with this. So I guess for us, it really means if China's going to expect this sort of thing, then we should also expect more mistakes.
Now, North Korea has developed a certain sort of eccentricity over recent decades. But on the Chinese side, we've seen this staggering economic growth. But at the same time, has there been much of a foreign policy change to match that?
From China, I think there has, you know, there's been the sort of attempt to stick close to the idea of non-interference in the affairs of other countries. And, you know, really this has been the dominant kind of approach since 1955, basically. But this is, you know, a problem because now China is not a small developing economy country. It's a, you know, massive economy. It's still a developing country, but I mean, in many areas, it's pretty developed. And this gives it a prominence, really, and an importance, which it's never had before. And which, you know, with the best will in the world, because it's happened so quickly, means that you know, people just in the policy-making apparatus in Beijing haven't been prepared, and you know, are kind of playing catch-up in some areas of policy all the time because the expectations on them now are so huge.
And Kerry, you mentioned that Chinese sort of creed of non-interference, and it has been noticeable that they've acquired this sort of pseudo-empire around the world basically by buying it rather than conquering it and just being very businesslike about it. But is there any at all ideological aspect to their foreign policy in the way that there is with obviously the United States? Is there any sense of China trying to export Chinese values?
There's a big controversy over this and of what exactly Chinese values are. Are they trying to export their political model? I think no. Are they trying to export a kind of, you know, ways of, you know, sort of increasing their influence? I mean, everyone does this, really. I mean, you know, up to a point, all investments are to try and, you know, increase influence. I think the issue really is that the Chinese, as external investors, have never, you know, that's never really happened before. So it's a new thing, and it takes a little while for us to sort of get used to it. It's still relatively small scale, so we don't really have a lot to go on to say, well, what China will look like in this new guise. And I suppose the final thing is, you know, there's certainly sort of some requirements. China is cautious at investing in countries that still recognize Taiwan over Beijing. And so it sort of has that political requirement. Whether it requires other things, I mean, this is very hard to sort of make a kind of categorical declaration. There's just a suspicion, I suppose, that it has political requirements, particularly over, you know, issues like Tibet or China not being embarrassed by being condemned for human rights issues and things like this. And probably countries which are middle to, you know, sort of large-size economy can, you know, sort of push back. But smaller developing countries on the whole are much less, you know, inclined to sort of say, you know, we're not going to be pushed around like this, and tend to fall in line now. And this is one area of change.
Is there a sense with a situation like this that it's almost a test for China's role as a superpower going forward?
I mean, because China's prominent now, it's active in all sorts of areas. Many of these areas are very sensitive, very unstable. Some areas in Africa, some areas in Middle East, Central Asia. I mean, other areas in Asia. Itself, we can just expect more of this. I mean, basically, China is a developing power, and it's learning a lot of hard lessons. I think it's not going to be a straightforward role. It wasn't for anyone else. Why should it be for China? The demands on it are going to get stronger. It's going to have to take a position on things that it would like to keep out of. And the Middle East problems have kind of shown this in a way where it would have probably wanted to get out of issues in Libya, and certainly in Syria, but has been given pressure and has to, you know, it's had to change its position. And so, you know, I think we just have to expect more and more of this, because the bottom line is that China's a huge economy now, the world's second largest, and it can't carry on behaving like it's, you know, the world's sort of 20th or 30th largest economy. It's far too prominent.
And the other big foreign policy question that China has faced recently, and it's another one of those sort of querulous, annoying, pinpricky things, is its standoff with the Philippines over the Scarborough Shoals. Is there anything in China's handling of that which has surprised you or struck you as evidence of any sort of new thinking?
I think it's, you know, kind of part of this pattern of becoming more assertive, and, you know, the fact that there seemed to be a statement of Chinese sovereignty over this area, which was kind of new. From, I think, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs a couple of weeks ago, maybe a week ago. You know, this is a kind of bolder step. There's a sort of boldness. But, I mean, you know, I mean, the bottom line is that we're going to have to work ways around this. The issue about Chinese maritime borders is that many of these involve areas of sort of, you know, rich natural resources. China is hungry for these, and it can't be passive about this sort of issue. It can't just say, oh, we can leave this, you know, for another 10 years, another 20 years, because it needs to somehow do a deal now. Smart diplomacy would obviously say, well, we'll use international law and we'll deal with it that way, and, you know, everyone will kind of have to compromise. I guess the worst sort of scenario is that China might think, no, we're going to kind of push this to resolve it in our favor completely without having any of the other competing partners get anything from it. And that would cause, I mean, the, you know, the sort of lighter outcome would be enormous bad feeling. The worst outcome would be, you know, real conflict. I mean, real conflict.
Kerry Brown of Chatham House, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be right back.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers, putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films, from affairs to business, culture to design, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
The June issue of Monocle is a round-the-world ticket that takes in the best boats and planes and trains in our annual transport survey. We also reach for the skies as we climb to the top of Tokyo's new Skytree Tower, stay ahead as we meet an Ethiopian Olympic icon, and visit Kolkata as the city tries to step up a gear. And there's lots more.
In the culture section, Aisha Spears looks beyond the Steers and Stetsons to profile the gallerists and collectors at this year's Dallas Art Fair. Design Miami founder Craig Robbins talks us through his art, and there's a wonderful column on the art of wandering.
In the design section, we head north to Stockholm for a global exclusive of Ett Hem, a small hotel with big ambitions to shake up the hospitality industry.
There's also our 36-page Thailand National Survey that puts a spotlight on the country's top tech firms, horticultural hothouses, and some cool brewers too. The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
We will now play our first song of the evening. Just as we were going to air, we heard about the sad passing of Donna Summer at the age of 63. This is Love to Love You. Vale, Donna Summer, who died earlier today, age 63. That was, of course, Love to Love You, Baby. It's Thursday on Midori House, and that means checking in with Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald. Usually, he descends to the studio from his perch upstairs, but this evening, he is on the line from San Francisco. Good evening, Hugo.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. It's a very cold morning in San Francisco.
Good. I'm glad other people are as miserable as those of us in London have been now for what feels like about a million years. What are you up to in San Francisco?
I am here on a sort of a US jaunt at sea. I spoke to you from Chicago a couple of days ago. I'm in San Francisco for a flying visit because Monocle is opening a temporary shop-in-shop in a lovely boutique here called Union Made this evening.
Excellent.
Also, I'm catching up with some old friends and talking to some new designers who are opening various small manufacturing businesses back in the heart of the city.
But the Monocle shop, he said, moving seamlessly along, I'm sure is better designed than most British homes, according to new research published today by the Royal Institute of British Architects. What are British households doing wrong?
Well, it's the first study of its kind that's been done by Ipsos Mori, or rather the first of its kind for about 50 years, for the Royal Institute of British Architects. And it's not groundbreaking discoveries. Just a big thing that comes out of it is that British people need more space for storage in their homes. Apparently, people are having to keep their vacuum cleaners with their parents who live down the road. People are having to keep the huge amount of groceries that they're buying at supermarkets in their cars. They don't have enough room in their houses to store all these things. But what seems kind of obvious to me is that maybe people should just start buying less stuff or throwing more stuff away.
That would seem the obvious solution, yes. But, I mean, it is true that I think a lot of British people live in households built, obviously, a long, long time ago, which have rather been outstripped by the stuff that people now want to put in them.
Exactly. Well, no, you're right. There's an excess of stuff and also a sort of lack of an update in the way that houses are designed. But the reason I chose this story to talk about is because in Chicago, the reason I was there was doing a review of these two enormous tower blocks that were built in the 1960s as a sort of experiment to bring suburban living into a vertical sort of apartment block situation in downtown Chicago. And these were designed in very sort of handy little units that people could customize, and they were built in the 60s, so the spaces were small. And I visited about 15 people who were living there today, and they have absolutely no problem with storage whatsoever. And this is America, where we assume that maybe people buy more things than they do in Britain. But this is a case that actually it's, I think, more about the way that we live rather than places that we live in that needs addressing.
Is there any sense that there's been any sort of particular changes in the way people live from the 60s until now? What do we care more about now that we cared less about then?
It sort of goes back to space, really. I think in the 60s, everybody was very happy to have their homes divided into different units that were sort of delineated by what they did there. So you would have a separate kitchen, you'd have a dining room, you'd have a living room, bedroom, bathroom, whatever. Whereas now, everybody wants to live in one space that they do everything in, except maybe perhaps the toilet, which remains a separate room. But for building standards authorities, it's very difficult to just go around tearing down walls when you feel like you want to combine your bedroom with your living room. And I think this is sort of why people have started to clutter up these tiny little rooms rather than open them out. The big problem is the new developments that are built are still built along the same lines as they were in the 60s. There hasn't been much sort of thought to address the way in which people live, which is exactly why the Royal Institute of British Architects has conducted this study, to sort of give a bit of an update on that. So maybe housing developments in the future might look a little bit different.
Hugo, we'll let you go on to enjoy the rest of your day in San Francisco. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. In the next half hour on Midori House, we will meet the author of a powerful new novel about history and memory. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. Prosecutors on the second day of the genocide trial of the Serb general Ratko Mladic have announced that they were indefinitely suspending the presentation of evidence. Earlier, prosecutors described 5 days of terror in the Bosnian enclave of Srebrenica in July 1995, when troops under Mladic's command massacred more than 7,000 men. The Olympic torch is due to arrive at the most southwesterly point of Britain tomorrow before it embarks on an 8,000-mile, 8,000-person journey around the country. Organisers deliberately chose a lower-profile relay than the route for the 2008 Beijing Olympics after violent demonstrations against China's human rights record and its policy on Tibet. The Israeli Defence Minister Ehud Barak has arrived at the Pentagon today for a meeting with the US Defence Secretary Leon Panetta. The United States has pledged nearly $700 million over 3 years to help pay for the Iron Dome missile defence system equipment, which can destroy rockets 40 miles away. On the same theme, Australia and Japan have signed an information security agreement today in a bid to deepen bilateral defence ties between the two countries. And South African maritime authorities are trying to salvage a Japanese fishing vessel that ran aground in Cape Town's premier Clifton Beach. They were trying to prevent any pollution spilling out by pumping out the oil first. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. 31 minutes past 1800 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Dance.
You are cordially invited to tune into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition, we celebrate the art of wandering with writer and psychogeographer Ian Sinclair. Enjoy live music from Astrid Williamson, kick-ups and dusty grooves in Chicago, and a lead through a chaotic maze in Paris by Jean Deloisy.
You have all the transformation of the self-portrait of Picasso slowly becoming a minotaur.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Well, Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's coming up for 33 minutes past 1800 hours in London. A well-worn quip, usually if apocryphally attributed to Winston Churchill, says of Irish history that the British should learn it and the Irish should forget it. It encapsulates a conundrum faced by many societies trying to forge a path futurewards from a past of chaos or conflict. To what extent should there be a reckoning of past misdeeds, and at what point should all concerned drop it and move on?
Well, joining us now is Patrick Flannery, whose new novel Absolution poses these and other questions in the context of post-apartheid South Africa. Welcome, Patrick. Now, you were born in California and raised in Omaha. What's your connection with South Africa?
Well, the simple answer is that my partner is South African, so I have a kind of familial connection to it. But the book didn't actually begin as a South African novel at all. It started as a kind of offshoot of research that I was doing for my doctorate on writers' relationships with institutions of censorship. So it began as a kind of dialogue between an author figure and a biographer. And it was only later that I decided that it needed a very particular kind of setting.
So what was it that appealed? Because obviously there's many places in the world where that conflict exists between authors and people who don't want to let them write. What was it about South Africa, of all the ones you could have chosen?
Well, again, the sort of simple answer is that I felt I had a certain amount of access to it culturally because of my my partner, but also because I'd been doing research on J.M. Coetzee's work, and it was very suggestive, and it wasn't just about the writer's relationship with the censor that I was beginning to think about, but about these larger kinds of issues of complicity in institutions of oppression.
The writer's complicity with the institutions.
Correct. Yes.
I mean, do you think that's a common place though? Because this is having travelled myself in a lot of places where there are those institutions of repression, and having met the authors who struggle to labour under them, it is an interesting question. At what point the writer starts doing the censor's job for them? Yes. by censoring themselves? Indeed. I mean, how do you think a writer protects themselves from something like that?
Well, that's a very good question. I think as I was beginning the very early stages of the book, which was in 2005, I was then a student at Oxford. I was living in Sheffield. So I was here in the United Kingdom as somebody whose freedom felt certain to a certain extent curtailed. I felt as though what I was able to say wasn't entirely open. And because it was also at that moment in the Iraq War when there was a huge amount of dampening of speech in the United States, I was thinking very much about how an author in systems of crisis, I suppose, social crisis, but also in much more formal systems of oppression as existed in apartheid South Africa, might react to it.
But those are interesting, though, because the obviously in American Britain it isn't so much formalized in the way that it was under something like South African rule. Did you, in terms of researching the book, did you speak to many South African writers who'd labored through that period?
I didn't actually speak to them, but I certainly did research about it. And J.M. Coetzee's book of essays, Giving Offense, which is a very astute analysis of various kinds of writers' relationships with censorship, was an important source for the book. But also, just anecdotally, I was aware of all kinds of writers' relationships with the censors, in part through the work of the great Oxford literary scholar Peter MacDonald, who's written a fantastic book which is called The Literature Police, and that's about the history of censorship in South Africa, and it was an extremely important text.
I mean, you write a lot. One of the pillars of the plot is a kind of a fictional case presented to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was created in the post-apartheid years as a historical reckoning. Did your researchers lead you to come down on one side or the other as to whether this whole idea of, you know, letting the sunlight in is a good idea, or do you think there are times at which it is just best to, and this is about to be the worst mixed metaphor in the history of broadcast, it's sometimes better to ignore the elephant in the room, which is obviously filled with sunlight now at this point in our metaphor.
Beautiful elephant.
It's a nice warm elephant.
No, I certainly come down on the side of feeling as though the TRC was an extraordinarily important beginning of a process. And it's a process which is still ongoing in a more informal sense, and one I think that has to continue. And there's still a huge amount of reckoning to be done, I think, about the kinds of atrocities that were never adequately investigated in some cases. There are still many, many people whose deaths are not adequately explained and missing who are not accounted for.
Have you spent a lot of time looking at contemporary parallels now? I mean, I'm thinking of Cambodia and the huge international court that's been set up there to try and do this same process of dealing with something from the past. And there's a huge debate going on there about how worthwhile it is. Has your reading sort of made you look at that situation any differently?
I didn't do active research about other specific contexts, but I was thinking very much as I was writing it that the book could very easily be set in any number of other countries, South America. I think Peru had its own TRC as well, but also much closer to home here, Northern Ireland. You know, it could very easily be a British story.
Very much so. The other way the book is structured interested me well as a journalist, in that you present versions of the same events told from, I think, four different perspectives. Mm. And obviously one of the infuriating and frustrating but kind of interesting things about journalism is if you talk to different people separately who are present at entirely the same event, you will hear absolutely, often actually contradictory versions of events. You will hear versions of events that cannot possibly all be true. Mm. Given the unreliability of human memory, how reliable do you think such processes can be?
You mean processes like the TRC?
Like the TRC, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because the TRC, the commission itself, was very concerned to think about four different kinds of truth that might exist. So they thought about forensic truth, narrative truth, dialogic or discursive truth, and restorative truth. So in a sense, the book is also an attempt to speak to the possibility of there being these kind of coexisting truths, no one of which is necessarily the best truth or the ultimate truth, but they all exist in sort of contemporaneous ways.
Has there been any reaction to the book from inside South Africa? I know it can be, you can get yourself into a weird area where you start, I guess, taking charge of other people's traumas, as it were, and presenting them. Even as a journalist, you will get the occasional sort of pushback of, well, who the hell are you to try and tell our story? Have you had any of that?
Yeah. I was just in South Africa in April, launching the book effectively, and there was a very nice review by a great critic, Michael Teitelstad, there in South Africa's Mail and Guardian. And he, I think the title of the review was Cross-Border Raid Forgiven, and he describes me as an insider outsider. But I was certainly very conscious of the fact that there has long been a sense in South Africa that it's a country that should be able to tell its own stories. And so I knew that I was, in many ways, letting myself in for a certain amount of criticism about taking this on. And I just hope that South African readers will read it and make up their own minds about whether I've done it justice.
Well, we started by talking about your non-South African background on this South African subject. I mean, do you think with these four kinds of truth, for instance, that you're in a unique position as an outsider to be able to tell it a certain way?
That's a good question. I don't think that outsider status is necessarily a certain, it doesn't necessarily provide a kind of privilege, but it might mean that because I'm not totally embedded within the country and the culture, that I am able to see it, if not in a better way, at least in a slightly different way.
Well, you could also argue that the outsider isn't, and I think it's a recurring theme of the novel, that whatever people's intentions are, when you live through something as corrupting as apartheid is, or as institutionally corrupt as apartheid was, it's very hard not to become corrupted yourself, even if you're trying very hard not to.
Well, the book is in many ways about different forms of complicity, and that's what the characters grapple with. Sam, the biographer, and Claire, the novelist whose biography he's writing, are both trying to come to terms with the ways in which they might have been complicit in crimes of various magnitude, from quite minor to something much more serious, like the assassination of Claire's sister.
Patrick Flannery, author of Absolutions, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now for another song. It's been a bad day for music. Not only did we lose Donna Summer, as we played earlier, and not only did we lose Doug Dillard of the Dillards, who made a splendid record circa early 70s with Gene Clark of the Byrds, but we also lost Chuck Brown, the godfather of go-go, who died yesterday, age 75. This is Bustin' Loose.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, we cover people-centered businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
The latest episode of The Entrepreneurs kicks off by looking at Berlin's burgeoning tech scene through the lens of Gidsy, a startup specialising in trading experiences. We were then joined in the studio by former furniture designer William Kroll, founder of British fashion and craft brand Tender, as well as checking in on a Parisian shoemaker who gave up consultancy to follow his dream business.
I decided to create a shoe brand because I wanted to mix, on the one hand, business and on the other hand, creativity and arts.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Coming up to 1848 here in London, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller and Dom Reynolds. Now, today, Francois Hollande flew straight from his dinner in Berlin with German Chancellor Angela Merkel to the US, where he'll be meeting President Barack Obama at the White House. Along with talking at a global leaders' summit at Camp David and a meeting of NATO chiefs in Chicago, Hollande will have to justify his plans, at the risk of tempting all sorts of obvious jokes, to withdraw French troops from Afghanistan a year earlier than planned.
So what can we expect from the relationship between the two leaders? Well, a little earlier, Christian Yeo spoke to Naomi Scherbel-Bell, journalist and French politics expert, and started by asking her if this was the start of a blossoming relationship between Merkel and Hollande.
Well, Angela Merkel says that she has welcomed François Hollande with open arms, but she did controversially openly back the former French president Nicolas Sarkozy in his election campaign. So they'll have to start a new relationship. François Hollande has said that he wants to focus Europe towards growth, and he has mentioned changing or adding to the fiscal pact, which is one of the austerity measures that has been introduced, that Merkel has been worried about François Hollande wanting to change the direction that she was taking with his predecessor. So on Tuesday, when François Hollande was inaugurated, he flew to one of his first visits. His very first visit was to visit Angela Merkel. Rather auspiciously, his plane was hit by lightning.
Absolutely. Ominous.
Yes, but he came back and changed planes and continued to Germany. And Angela Merkel said that was in many ways symbolic of their future relationship. That there may be one or two hiccups over the way, but what she said was important was that François Hollande persevered, and that showed that that Franco-German relationship is vital.
But he's come into this new job at the most tumultuous time in Europe. We've seen what's happening in Greece. This sort of growth austerity debate is going on across Europe, and he will now be central to that. Do you think that he's sort of prepared for the job? I mean, it's an enormous thing to take on. He's in a very pivotal position. Do you think that he is going to be able to work with Angela Merkel?
Well, François Hollande has been around in French politics for a long time, but crucially, he hasn't got any ministerial experience. Yesterday evening, he announced his new cabinet, and as his foreign minister, he's appointed Laurent Fabius, who was prime minister under President Mitterrand many years ago. So he has got some experienced ministers amongst his new cabinet, and Laurent Fabius is crucial. That's why he was chosen, because he is seen as a heavyweight. Equally, his finance minister, Pierre Moscovici, has background in European politics. And also his prime minister, who in some ways were a very close ally of François Hollande and in some ways a surprise appointment. His prime minister, crucially, is a German speaker. So I think the questions about the European economy were very much one of the most pressing issues on his agenda. It's his first cabinet meeting today, which he'll hold before going over to the US. So the economy is going to be one of those key questions at that meeting. Yeah.
Based on his previous comments, it had been sort of perceived that he might be the leader or the poster boy of a rollback of these austerity measures that we've seen and this integration of Europe.
it doesn't appear to be the case. He does appear to be more on the same page with Merkel than anticipated, or would you say there is an element of superficiality to this? This is, we must appear to be getting on well.
Well, the German press, when he visited Germany earlier this week, said that it was sort of couples counselling. So they do have different views on the direction that things need to take. What François Hollande said initially, that he wanted to renegotiate this crucial fiscal pact, which says that places a strict limit on the amount of the percentage of debt in the country's GDP across Europe. And François Hollande initially said that he wanted to renegotiate that pact, and that caused alarm bells across the sort of conservative alliance across Europe. What he's now said is that he wants to complete that pact. So he's saying yes to some austerity measures, but he wants to also focus Europe on growth.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, sometime in the 20th century, the act of taking a photograph became the art of photography. And there's one place in London that can take more credit than anywhere else for changing the way photography is seen in Britain. And the Photographer's Gallery has now been undergoing a bit of redevelopment itself. Monocle's Katie Bilboa has snuck in to give us this preview.
I'm Brett Rogers, the director of the Photographer's Gallery. Today relaunches the new Photographer's Gallery. We've been closed for 18 months while we've been rebuilding our site in Ramillies Street, just near Oxford Circus. We moved here in 2008 out of our venue where everybody was very used to going for 37 years in Great Newport Street in Leicester Square. And we occupied the building temporarily for 18 months before we closed with the Sally Mann exhibition on October 2010. And for the last 18 months, we've been building our new building here, designed by the Irish architects O'Donnell and Toomey, and they've transformed a 1910 warehouse into a state-of-the-art 21st century gallery for photography. We've been able to double the exhibition space and give ourselves two lovely high-ceiling spaces at the top of the building, which will afford us the opportunity to show international artists of the 21st century. And we've also been able to include an education floor, because prior to this, everybody who came here for our lectures and events would have to do so at night. We had to run everything after the gallery closed at 6 o'clock. And now we can do that all day, every day, and offer people opportunities for learning and education.
And how did you choose which artists you would display on this opening exhibition?
I wanted to choose an artist who I felt very passionately about, but more importantly, who would reveal some of the qualities of the space. So Ed Butinsky's large-scale panoramic images of oil seemed to me to be the perfect thing to launch the space.
The whole show is divided into three chapters. This section over here is about extraction and refinement. And so I'm looking at areas where oil's been taken from the ground.
My name is Edward Bertinsky. I'm a photographer working as an artist for over 30 years, photographing man's industrial incursions into the landscape. I started this project in kind of 1997, and then around 2008, I had finished most of the shooting for it. Then it took a year to put the show together and to put the book together, and then we launched the inaugural book and show at the Corcoran Gallery in 2010, and we've done about a dozen venues so far.
I just wanted to get your opinion on this new space as a gallery. What do you make of it, and how do you feel as the first exhibitor in the new space?
Well, I love the new space. I think it's a fantastic contribution to the London scene. I think London really needed to have a gallery devoted to photography in its downtown core, and I feel privileged to be the photographer chosen to kick off the new building. And I think they've done a smashing job, as they say in England. It's beautifully done. You know, they haven't cut any corners. They've added two floors to their existing building, and and it feels perfect. It feels great.
How significant a space do you consider yourself now in comparison to other galleries?
Well, I think finally we can hold our heads high and feel as though, you know, we've always really beaten above our weight for our scale and for the quality of our spaces. But now we're up there with the Whitechapel and the Serpentine, I feel, and be able to offer artists an interesting space in which to display their work. And our public, the facilities that they're used to. People used to come to our lectures and have to sit on uncomfortable chairs, and there used to be noise outside, and now we can offer them comfort, cooling and quiet spaces in which to reflect on the art that they're looking at.
My name is Henrik Woltersdorf. I'm working for Donald Toomey Architects, and we're the architects on the Photographers Gallery. At the moment, we're standing on the roof level of the existing, and so we added two floors on top of it and gave the whole building a very vertical expression, including with the new window to facing Oxford Street, which should be kind of almost a lighthouse to Oxford Street. We opened the cafe to the street, and then we opened the floor to the basement. So basically, we gained another floor to the building in opening up the basement to the ground floor. So basically, the bookshop and the print sales are in the downstairs. So the basement doesn't feel like a basement anymore.
And the other new thing about this building is that...
How much does the market influence what you display, and how much is it based on the kind of creative side of it?
In the public programme, the market has absolutely no bearing on what we show. We have to be convinced by an artist, and we have six different sort of categories in our programming strategy in which we fulfil, which is, supporting young British artists, solo group shows, supporting excellence through Deutsche Börse and the vernacular. So these are the more important things. It's never the market that drives the public programme. In print sales, what we're trying to do there is we have a lot of loyalty from the old guard, the people who've been exhibiting with print sales since the 1970s, and they are the more classic photographers such as George Roger and Salgado. But what we're really trying to do is to promote younger, emerging photographers, because so many of them coming out of university today in college don't have a place to show. So we feel it's our responsibility to try and help them have their first exhibition in print sales and to launch them really onto the market. The next show is Deutsche Börse with the four artists, Christopher Williams, John Sezica, Rinko Kurauchi and Peter Hugo, a wonderfully strong selection this year. And alongside that is an exhibition about the history of the Japanese photo book. And that's also something we're very committed to, because we do feel that photography is quite unique in using the book form as a vehicle for creative expression. So we'll be celebrating that.
And is the aim that you will be considered up there on the international stage as well as big on the national stage?
I think that even internationally now, we are the premier space for photography in the UK. But, we work very closely with the National Media Museum, Impressions, and all the network of fabulous publicly funded galleries up and down the country, because with their support and together we can create a real hub for photography and excellence in the UK.
It's unclear what the critical response to the newly refurbished gallery will be. Whispers and lifts in hallways seem to point to a mixed picture. You could argue that they've played it safe with their choice of content and that the lighting and architecture are somewhat uninspired. But many of Bartinsky's images are arresting and bold, and I, for one, was glad to see the gallery, which was in much need of a facelift, at least beginning its journey to becoming the global home for photography that it deserves to be. For Monocle in London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
That was Katie Bilboa reporting from the New Look Photographers Gallery, and that's all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. Thanks to my co-host Don Reynolds, producer Paul Noble, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Alex Jacques. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.